Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Well, it's been 25 years since the theatrical world shifted on its axis with the premiere of Angels in America, an epic history play by Tony Kushner, which flowed from his pen in such places as Cafe Flore right here in San Francisco and a cottage on the Russian River in Guerneville. Its creation, gestation, birth, and rebirth is documented in an extraordinary oral history volume by Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce, with recollections of some 200 individuals that had something to do with the play in its various incarnations. I'm pleased to say that that book is available to you for a $120 contribution to KLW during this hour, as are a pair of tickets to see the Berkeley Rep production and the oral history book for a $500 contribution when you call 800-525-9917. Those are available only by phone, by the way. I'll also talk with the champion of the Great American Songbook, multi-platinum-selling, five-time Grammy-nominated recording artist Michael Feinstein, who is at his namesake cabaret venue at the Hotel Nikko here in San Francisco through Sunday. We also have a ticket incentive today during open air for that. For a $500 contribution, a pair of tickets to Michael's show tomorrow evening. Stay with us, or better yet, call now, 800-525-9917, and take advantage of these special gifts. We only can have two pairs to Michael's show tomorrow and one pair for Angels in America at Berkeley Rep as we get the show underway.
Must I memorize a book to be considered wise, when I can look into your eyes? Literature is such a bore, and mathematics too. I'd much prefer to learn about you. You're the only kind of knowledge they don't teach at any college. You're an education in yourself. There are poems and romances in the glamour of your glances. You're an education in yourself. Of all the famous dates in history, I recall the 4th of July and my dates with you. You've a kiss that's scientific, though it's tender, it's terrific. You're an education in yourself.
That's the distinctive voice of singer Michael Feinstein and the great Harry Warren Al Dubin tune from the hit parade of 1938. You're an education. Well, it's an education, really a master class. When I hear Michael Feinstein sing, I learn something about phrasing and about artistry as well as musicality. It's hard to think of anyone doing more to preserve, protect, and promote the Great American Songbook than my guest Michael Feinstein. After being introduced to Ira Gershwin in the late 70s, he was hired as archivist and helper to the legendary lyricist and brother of George Gershwin. And his work and friendship with him not only yielded some unheard gems of the repertoire, but also, according to his widow, extended Ira's life after having fallen into a late-life depression. In the early 90s, Michael embarked on an ambitious songbook project wherein he performed an album featuring the music of a featured composer, often accompanied by the composer, including collaborations with the great Burton Lane, Julie Stein, Jerry Herman, Hugh Martin, Jimmy Webb, among others. Collaborations also for recordings with Maynard Ferguson and with Cheyenne Jackson in performance and on CD. Michael was named Principal Pops Conductor for the Pasadena Pops in 2012, a contract that has been extended. Under his leadership, the Pasadena Pops has been delivering definitive performances of rare orchestrations and classic arrangements of the Great American Songbook. And in addition to doing more than 150 live performances per year, Michael has appeared on a number of television series, documentaries, talk shows, And as I mentioned, he's in town for several shows at his namesake cabaret venue, Feinstein's at the Nikko, as its name implies, in the Nikko Hotel near Union Square here in San Francisco. A pleasure to have Michael Feinstein in studio for a chat. Hi, Michael.
Hello, David. Thank you.
I could gush on and on.
Don't, please.
Well, let's start with that opening tune, Harry Warren tune from 1938. You had a personal connection with Harry Warren around the same time you were working with Ira Gershwin. Tell us about that.
Well, Harry Warren is the forgotten guy of American music. He was the most successful songwriter of the 20th century, wrote scores for 82 motion pictures, 3 Academy Awards for Lullaby Broadway, You'll Never Know, on the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. And I adored him. He was this great guy who was a curmudgeon, had a big feud with Irving Berlin because Irving Berlin always thought he was superior, but Harry had more hits. During the Second World War, the Allies bombed Germany, and Harry called up a friend and said, they bombed the wrong Berlin.
Oh, ouch. Sing.
But I loved him and try and sing his music as often as I can.
Well, you mentioned just a couple of those, but I mean, tunes like Jeepers Creepers, You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby, That's Amore, The More I See You.
I Only Have Eyes for You. I mean, the list is extraordinary because he had hits from the 20s all the way through the 60s, and he was incredibly prolific.
So from that association, did you unearth some Harry Warren gems that are now back with us, dusted off, so to speak?
Yeah, quite a few. Actually, there's one song he wrote with Ira Gershwin called There Is No Music. It was intended for Judy Garland when she was supposed to make the movie The Barclays of Broadway with Fred Astaire. And she was ill and left the film. And I sang it, and now a lot of people have picked it up and sing that. And it just feels good to help get something like that out in the world. It's a great song. It's kind of a precursor lyrically to The Man That Got Away, very kind of dark, unusually so for the 40s.
Well, that might be a good segue to ask about trunk songs. For people that aren't familiar...
I got worried. I thought you said Trump songs.
Well, I've got a few of those, too.
Trunk. Let's stick with
You're
Trump
mean
songs.
You're a mean one, Mr. Trump. It's been done.
Yeah, trunk songs. Let's do trunk songs. Yeah.
Explain
for
to our audience.
For 100, Alex. Yeah.
Explain to our audience what a trunk song is for those that aren't familiar with the term.
A song that was written for something and not used and then lay fallow, and later was revived. Like Urine Education was actually written for a Warner Brothers movie but not used. I'm trying to think of an example of a song that was a trunk song that actually came to prominence. Well, it's like... Love Is Here to Stay was written for the Goldwyn Follies, and it wasn't a trunk song, but it was completely unknown until it was used later in the movie An American in Paris and suddenly gained recognition. But a trunk song is a song that never was heard before. For example, the other night, I sang a song called San Francisco that was written for the movie that starred Jeanette MacDonald and Clark Gable, and it was a song written for Jeanette to sing, and the producers threw it out and had another song called San Francisco written. So I sang the early one that no one's ever heard. San Francisco, I've been so blue, I can't wait till I get back to you. And it's it's a Jolson kind of, but it's a great song, but no one's ever heard it.
Interesting stuff. I enjoyed hearing that last night. Unfortunately, that's about all I heard. I heard your encores, which you were very generous with your encores. I got the timing of your show last night. Who does a show at 7 o'clock?
Well, I guess I didn't know it either. They pushed me on stage. I said, wait, no, I don't know. I don't often know what time zone I'm in, so it's not my fault.
Well, that's true enough. You also, in your encores, offered a healthy selection of Sinatra, who you have a great... tribute to and of great reverence for, as I think most people that do even a modest amount of singing or enjoy the Great American Songbook do.
Well, I was lucky to meet Sinatra, and he was great. He was great to me, very, very kind, and he was a volatile man, but he was very encouraging. And when I first met him, I was playing at a birthday party for his wife, Barbara, and I was playing all these songs trying to get him to pay attention to me, trying to get him to notice me, because I was, the hired hand in the background at the little upright piano. And I was playing all these obscure songs from movies he'd been in, and he came over to me after about an hour and said, Jesus, how do you know all those songs? How old are you, 12? And then he invited me to sit down and started telling me stories, and it was wonderful. He was very sweet to me.
That's neat. Well, to quote the immortal lyrics of Stephen Sondheim and the Julie Stein tune from Gypsy, you got to get a gimmick. You've been doing these cabaret shows for a number of years, dare I say decades now.
Yeah.
What's your focus or gimmick this time around? 5 years at the NECO, by the way.
Well, it's sort of a smorgasbord because we are celebrating 5 years of Feinstein's at the NECO, which is really fantastic.
So nice of Senator Feinstein to let you use her little cabaret there.
I know, and I have the hair like hers too, which is a very important part of the tribute. But yeah, I mean, having 5 years here is special to me because my nightclub career really started in San Francisco. I was playing piano bars, but nightclub performing started here. And so it's important to me personally. So this is not a musical retrospective, but I do include certain things that people connect with me through the years. And I always have a request section. And then I do some more contemporary things as well, because I always like to present surprises. That's, I think, one of the things that has helped to sustain me through the years.
Speaking of which, you call yourself not only an archivist, but an archaeologist. What sort of things have you uncovered that you're proud to bring back into this world?
It's wonderful to find obscure, unknown. I found three manuscripts of songs by Jerome Kern that are completely undocumented, unknown, or to take a Gershwin melody that had no lyrics and years later find the lyric sheet that fit with it, to somehow figure out that those two go together. Or find lost orchestrations and play them live with the symphonies like the Pasadena Pops. There's a lot of stuff like that that's important to me.
Well, what is the status right now of the Great American Songbook Foundation, located in all places, Carmel, Indiana? Tell us about this foundation that you founded in 2008.
I started this organization to preserve American popular music and to keep it going for succeeding generations. One of the things that we do is have an annual high school songbook academy where kids from all over the United States apply, and they spend a week learning about the songbook. And it's an intensive where we have guides and mentors and judges, and then we have a songbook ambassador. And these are like planting little seeds where these young people that also listen to contemporary music discover this classic music, fall in love with it, and share it and spread it around. And it's life-changing for these kids because what they learn in interpreting the music and the life lessons that come from it really is something spectacular to behold. So that's an important part of what we do. The other part is that we're building a museum for American popular music, because there's a Country Music Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but there's no place for American songs. So we have amazing artifacts from Johnny Mercer and Margaret Whiting and Irving Berlin and George Gershwin and Cole Porter and the like. And then it's a research center. So it's a place that will keep this stuff alive, hopefully, for many, many years.
Well, do you take 50-year-old somethings into these classes?
Absolutely.
Can I come in disguise or something?
Well, all are welcome to come and come and observe, because it's sort of our own American Idol in Indiana. And we're there because the city of Carmel wanted to have us there, and they helped to fund us. And it's a model city. It was named by Money Magazine in 2012 as the number one most livable city in America. It's an extraordinary place. It's like a little oasis of culture and hope for the world.
Well, we love it when you come back to our little oasis called San Francisco and sing for us. I think three or four more performances through Sunday at Feinstein's at the NECO, your venue at the NECO Hotel. And for a $500 contribution to KLW, a very special gift, we're going to offer you two tickets to Michael's show tomorrow evening. Maybe he'll come by and say hello and thank you for supporting KLW. We have to talk him into that.
I promise I will. I'll take requests.
A $500 contribution when you call 800-525-9917. Because we only are offering two pairs, you do have to make the phone call for that gift. Meet and greet with Michael. Incredible show at Feinstein's at the NECO, and a little hello from him. 800-525-9917. Michael, we already have to say goodbye, and I want you to set up the song Rhode Island is Famous for You.
Introduced by Jack Haley, the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz, in a show called Inside USA, a musical review by Howard Dietz and Arthur Schwartz. And this song gets wackier and wackier with every verse, and I love it.
Michael Feinstein, thanks for coming in today. Have a great run here.
Thank you, David.
Every state in the USA has something it can boast of. A product that the state produces the most of. Rhode Island is little, but oh my, they have a product anyone would buy. Copper comes from Arizona. Peaches come from Georgia.
and lobsters come from Maine. The wheat fields are the sweet fields of Nebraska. Kansas gets bonanzas from the grain. Old whiskey comes from old Kentucky. Ain't the country lucky? New Jersey gives us glue. But you come from Rhode Island, and little old Rhode Island is famous for you. Cotton comes from Louisiana, gophers from Montana, spuds from Idaho. That plowland in the cowland of Missouri, where most beef meant for roast beef seems to grow. Grand Canyons come from Colorado. Gold comes from Nevada. Divorces also too. But you come from Rhode Island. Don't let them ride Rhode Island. It's famous for you. Come from Pennsylvania. Vests from West Virginia. Tents from Tennessee. They know mink where they grow mink in Wyoming. A camp chair in New Hampshire, that's for me. Minnows come from Minnesota. Coats come from Dakota. But why should you be blue? For you come from Rhode Island. We'll sing about Rhode Island and dance it. You enhance it more than Providence, Newport, Narragansett. Rhode Island's famous for you.
Amazing tune, amazingly sung by Michael Feinstein. Rhode Island is famous for you. Hey, you want to catch Michael's show tomorrow evening? Have a little meet and greet and perhaps ask him to sing a song for you. Well, if you call 800-525-9917 and are offering a $500 gift to KLW, we'll give you a pair of tickets to tomorrow's show at the Nico. Maybe throw in a free drink coupon as well. 800-525-9917. This is one of the greatest interpreters of the Great American Songbook that has lived and continues to thrive. Great show at the Nico. 800-525-9917 for tickets to Michael's show at the Nico. $500 gift to KLW. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, it has been 25 years since the theatrical world shifted on its axis with the premiere of Angels in America, this epic history play by Tony Kushner that garnered a Pulitzer Prize for Drama, a Tony Award for Best Play, Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Play. It's enjoyed another revival on Broadway and here at Berkeley Rep with Tony winner Steven Spinella, who is now in the role of Roy Cohn, and Randy Harrison as Prior Walter, Stephen's former role, both of whom you'll hear from later this hour. But first, a conversation with the authors of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce. It's a comprehensive oral history with recollections of some 200 individuals that had something to do with the play in its various incarnations. I'm pleased to say that the book you're going to be hearing about next is available to you for a $120 contribution during this hour, as are a pair of tickets to see the full epic Berkeley Rep production in two grand parts, Millennium Approaches and Perestroika, and the oral history book, so you can get tickets and the book for a $500 contribution. These gifts only available by phone, 800-525-9917. Now that conversation recorded earlier in Berkeley. Dan, Isaac, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Well, I had forgotten that this iconic work of American theater had its humble start in the tiny Eureka Theater here in San Francisco. But just as the Mormon character Joe Pitt recalls in the play his childhood Bible stories and his scene of wrestling, the angel wrestling with Jacob,
This work had a lot of wrangling going on to make it to its premiere at the Eureka.
Oh, yes. So it premiered in 1991 in the Eureka Theater, but even before that, it had a long life, a long development life here in San Francisco. Workshops, out in the Marin Headlands and in dance studios. And it was written, in fact, for a set of actors at the Eureka, a very politically active far-left theater in the Castro in the 1980s. And it was commissioned by that theater for that company of actors, which, much to Tony Kushner's surprise, after he pitched this idea for a play made up mostly of gay men, and Roy Cohn had an acting company made up mostly of women. And so, you know, the roles that we know, a lot of the roles that we know in this play, like Harper and Hannah, Joe Pitt's mother, and the Angel herself, were characters who were written originally for actresses at the Eureka.
And it all started from a dream that Tony Kushner had.
Yeah, that's correct. He had a dream. He knew this dancer who had contracted AIDS and was dying, whose name was Bill, and he had this dream about Bill lying in a hospital bed and an angel crashing through the ceiling of his hospital room. And he woke up and wrote down this poem, which he has said no one has ever seen and no one will ever see. He was very pointed with us about that, because believe me, we would have loved to have seen it, and he called the poem Angels in America. And years later, he used that title for the grant application for the play that would become Angels in America.
And used that image as the play's sort of defining image, the one that traveled with it throughout its entire development history, the one that both signified sort of this mix of the cosmological, the divine, and the prosaic, and that also, not coincidentally, I think, turned into the greatest challenge faced by every company that ever had to do this play, including the Eureka Theater here in San Francisco, which had to build a little house on its roof to house the angel in before they brought her in through the ceiling.
It's crazy. And then, of course, all kinds of legal wranglings once original creatives were lost, or actors were lost to the epidemic or for other reasons. A very sad story of the original Angel being lost to breast cancer, Sigrid Wurschmidt.
Yeah. I mean, that was actually, I think, one of our really important things that we kind of excavated over the course of doing this book, was that the Angel was written for another person. Ellen McLaughlin played it in sort of almost all but one of its public presentations from, you know, sort of early on in its development process through to Broadway. But it was actually originally written for Ellen's best friend, this woman, Sigrid Wurschmidt, who died of breast cancer. And actually, a lot of Sigrid's struggle is encoded in the play. The angel is called the Bald Eagle because Sigrid was doing chemo, and so she was bald. The angel's ill. You know, ever since reporting the book, every time I see Perestroika, I'm like, oh, right, the angel's sick, right? And Sigrid was sick. And, you know, she was an incredibly beloved member of the theater community here. It was really great to be able to kind of pay tribute to her and to that within the book.
There are amusing as well as heartbreaking reveals in this process of creating this incredible book, The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. One of the humorous things I'm recalling is Tony's relationship with the London director, Declan Donnellan, and the some 50 pages of notes that Tony faxed to London in the middle of the night from New York after seeing Donnellan's direction of part one.
Yeah, well, there are a number of stories in this book of Tony going toe-to-toe with directors. Curiously, Tony Ciccone here at Berkeley Rep seems to be the only director who's sort of managed to figure out how to manage that relationship in a way that feels fair and comfortable to everyone. It's not to say that other directors have sworn off working with Tony, but no director we talked to came out of it thinking, that went as smoothly as it could possibly have gone. But yes, Declan in London, you know, this is a very, very early production of the play at the National Theater in London. It was before the Broadway production, before even the Los Angeles production that followed the production here at the Eureka. And Declan is a wonderful director of the classics. His company, Cheek by Jowl, has done these incredible reinventions of classic texts for decades now. And this was the first time that he and his close collaborators had ever gotten their hands on an original script. And for Tony, having this visionary director dig into this script, someone who hadn't been involved in its development at all, was, I think, a difficult process. And so they clashed a lot. You know, they told us each of them told us we had a lot of arguments, which we resolved at high volume, but we're very close friends now. But yes, after seeing a preview, Tony came away convinced that Declan and his collaborators had ruined the play and that it would ruin everything. And so he typed up on an actual manual typewriter on the plane heading back to New York. Could you imagine being sitting next to someone with a manual typewriter typing 50 pages of notes on a transatlantic flight? And then he, as soon as he got home, faxed them. And Declan tells this remarkable story of being out that night at another show and coming home late at night, opening the door and thinking their apartment had been burgled. It was so filled with paper that it spit out of his fax machine and then spread all over the living room. And then Declan and his collaborators, I think, took very few of the notes, in fact, and stuck to their guns. And then Tony returned a few weeks later to see the show at opening and could not understand and believe that it, in fact, had transformed into something amazing.
And then later, Declan insisting on no revisions on, I think, for part two or for the next subsequent production.
An insistence that did not go heeded. an insistence that many directors have made and has never been heeded up to and including this production at Berkeley Rep, which includes lines that we are pretty sure we've never seen in any other production of Angels in America.
Yeah, you know, we've seen this show a lot. We've read it in many different drafts, and we've read screenplay drafts of it. You know, we know it pretty well at this point. So at each intermission, we would kind of check in with each other and be like, have you ever heard those lines before? And be like, no, those are absolutely brand new. And this production, actually, there's two scenes that were cut from Perestroika when it debuted on Broadway in 1994 that are included in the very back of the published script. There's two deleted scenes from Perestroika, and this production actually restores one of them. So if you're an Angels in America super fan, there is a rare chance to see Roy Cohn have a legal meeting with God in hell, which is usually cut from the script.
Well, now, is that due to Tony Taccone or Tony Kushner?
Well, we don't know, and we look forward to asking Tony Taccone tonight, actually.
I mean, Tony, you know, co-directed that scene in Los Angeles at the Mark Taper Forum in 1992. And that was the last time that a major production of the show included that scene, as far as I know.
Yeah, George Wolf cut it, and Ron Liebman told us the story who played Roy Cohn then, that, you know, he wanted to be a good boy. And so they said, we want to cut this, your last scene. And Ron said, well, will it make the play better? And they said, yes. And he said, cut it. And to this day, he still kind of
regrets, he has mixed opinions
about having been such a loyal soldier in that moment.
But so Tony knows about the scene. He's one of the few directors who has directed it on a stage. And so it wouldn't be surprising to me at all if he said, you know, I'm doing this play again. I want that scene. I love that scene and I want it.
Talking with Dan Coyce and Isaac Butler, co-authors of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. Happy coincidence that this is coming out just on the heels of the Broadway star-studded production, which received 11 Tony Award nominations, more than any other play in history, including for actors Andrew Garfield and Nathan Lane as Roy Cohn. And we have our own production here at Berkeley Rep with the original actor who played prior, Stephen Spinella, now in the role of Roy Cohn, and one of the original creatives, Tony Taccone, directing. Now, I'm assuming this book was all planned to come out at this time.
There was a lot of work involved in pushing the schedule enough so that we could take advantage of, you know, from a commercial standpoint, as authors, you want your book to come out at a time that's advantageous, but also we wanted the book to be part of a conversation that we knew would be swirling around this play in 2018 because of this Broadway revival, because of this production with Stephen here in Berkeley, and also because the issues at play in the show are so alive right now and feel so alive, I think, for many people in a way that maybe they haven't in some of the years between 1993 and now.
And I think, you know, the most obvious emblem of that is that we have this play that's returned where Roy Cohn is one of the main characters, and Roy Cohn's protege is our current president. And so there's been a lot of writing about that, and actually there's some discussion of it in our book, that, you know, not only the problems and questions and struggles of America that are in this play have become relevant again, but literally the play's cast has become relevant again, in that a lot of Americans need to relearn who Roy Cohn is and why his particular brand of, shall we say, pugnacious conservatism matters. And here's the play that really shows you that, but it's also like a funny, thrilling, great night at the theater.
Right. It's like really something to have this book out at the exact time that for the first time in probably 30 years, Roy Cohn is on the cover of New York Magazine again. It's tied to this, you know, remarkable essay by Frank Rich about that influence, his influence on Donald Trump and on conservatism.
I'm wondering, I haven't read the entire book yet. I'm looking forward to getting through as much as I can, and it is a page-turner. Was there controversy with Roy Cohn being the only actual by-name historical character in the play?
Not that I am aware of. Roy Cohn was always going to be part of the play. His name is apparently on the grant application to the NEA. It was always going to be about Mormons and gay men and AIDS and Roy Cohn. And actually, a lot of Tony's struggle in writing the play, in, you know, writing Millennium Approaches, the first part of the play, is actually figuring out that impulse he had that these ideas had something to do with one another. But no, the use of Roy has never been particularly controversial. There is some controversy, I feel like, maybe about Ethel Rosenberg, who I think, you know, but not really about Roy. Because Ethel Rosenberg, the ghost of Ethel Rosenberg, who Roy helped get executed through ex parte, you know, conversations with a judge, appears to sort of do a deathbed vigil for Cohn over the course of the play.
What we found in talking to people who were around for that initial production on Broadway, particularly in 93, is that for New Yorkers of that era, Roy Cohn, though he had died, you know, half a decade before, was still a very much a figure of their real New York lives, right? He wasn't just the guy in the Army McCarthy hearings. He wasn't just a guy in the society pages. He was a guy you saw going into Studio 54, or who you saw if you were a gay man in New York going into the Saint or other gay bars in the Village. And so he was, as Tony told Isaac for the profile that Isaac wrote of Nathan Lane in New York Magazine, he is a kind of famous person within the world of the play. And so he is treated in that way. He is known to all those other characters. Characters talk about him behind his back. Characters speculate about him. When he ends up in the hospital, he's immediately the subject of piping hot dish shared between characters. And so I think that for many people, he existed as a kind of emblem of a certain kind of New York, and in that way seemed fair game, not just because of his celebrity or because of historical importance, but because of the way he lived in the New York mythos for so many people of that time.
And obviously on Tony Kushner's mind as a New Yorker as well, who the tortured character Lewis is, who abandons his AIDS-ridden lover Pryor, is the playwright Tony Kushner, generated a lot of controversy due to the topic of AIDS and homosexuality, a lot of producers and other creatives not wanting to touch it with a 10-foot pole. The heartbreaking AIDS disease that F. Murray Abraham recalled claimed 80% of the cast of the show he was on at the time. It's truly amazing that this is as relevant now. And again, Tony's recollections working its way into the play, he recalls meeting adorable Mormon missionaries at his F train subway stop and actually talking to them, and hence the Mormon connection there.
It's interesting that you mention Lewis being Tony, because that, I think, is a subject of great debate among people. There, demographically, as Tony says, Lewis most closely resembles him, right? He is an intellectual, somewhat neurotic, gay Jew of a certain age, the age that Tony was when he was writing this play. And of course, we have actor upon actor telling us, oh yeah, well, Lewis is Tony, of course. He talks exactly like Tony. I didn't know how to do Lewis, but then I talked to Tony, and then I knew it. But at the same time, the sort of great betrayal of the play, right, the thing that turns audiences against Lewis, is not an experience that Tony has had, right? This moment that Lewis has of abandoning his lover when he's sick. And not only is it not something that Tony did, it's not something very notably that almost anyone did in that era. And that, I think, has been the sort of great controversy that followed the play for many years, is that the play about AIDS in America, the sort of canonical work, features at its heart someone abandoning a person in need, a thing that really didn't happen at that time.
Yeah, and the play actually, the second half of the play, Perestroika, gets pretty pointed about telling the audience that this story is not a stand-in for what happened amongst gay couples writ large during the AIDS crisis. There's a couple lines. Someone says to, you know, Pryor says to Lewis, you know, every other every other man who has this disease is being taken care of a lover but me. That's a horrible paraphrase. And Lewis says, like, I know that this is exceptional, what I've done, and that it's wrong. And, you know, we've spoken with Tony Kushner quite a bit about that. And in his perspective on it, and it's actually one that I think is really interesting, is that, you know, part of what theater does is stage the things we're most frightened of, because the theater is a safe environment. Nothing's going to happen to you. Nothing is actually physically or materially going to happen to you in a theater unless you're seeing some, I don't know,
some theater of cruelty gone awry.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so it's the place where you can go to see your fears dramatized. And so he wanted to dramatize this thing that was scaring everyone, that what if we are inadequate to take care of each other? And what if we are abandoned, or what if we end up being unable to do it and we abandon the person we love the most? And so he wanted to put that fear on stage and see what happened.
And in a way, the choice to sort of choose this exceptional case to explore the extreme version, this sort of in extremis version of the fears that he knew were shared by so many people during the epidemic, helps to make the play feel less like an artifact of its time, I think, and more like a kind of Shakespearean history play, where what is explored is not the experience of every gay person in New York in 1987, but what is instead explored is the kind of elemental fears and passions that drive us all that remain relevant now, even as AIDS is a very different disease in the lives of most gay men in America.
Well, this is an amazing collection of the recollections of some 250 or so people in this oral history, which grew from a Slate magazine article back in December of last year. Now,
pause. Let's retake that. It was in June of 2016.
June of 2016. Thank you for that clarification. Now, what are each of your memories of Angels and New York City at the time? Isaac Butler.
Sure. Well, I was living in D.C., and I was a theater kid who was politically active and interested in the struggle for gay liberation and for AIDS awareness. And we would always take these kind of pilgrimages to New York to take in an enormous amount of culture. We would do like a matinee and an evening performance for 3 days in a row and somehow sandwich a museum in there at the same time. And during one of those trips, my parents kind of dispatched me to see both parts of Angels in America over two consecutive days, over the course of a weekend. And I remember like just really vividly certain scenes, certain line readings, certain moments of the play have stuck with me even since then. And what's also stuck with me is just the feeling, particularly after Millennium Approaches was over, because in the second half, you've already seen Millennium Approaches, but when the end of Millennium Approaches, you're like, what is this thing that has never existed on Earth before? And as a politically minded teenager who loved theater, I felt like I suddenly understood how great politics and great theater could come together to make an even greater work of art. And I just felt, you know, it was late at night and I was walking through Times Square to get back to the hotel, and I just felt the most alive I had felt in a really long time. And like a lot of people of my generation, it kind of ruined me in a good way, because you don't get to see a lot of plays that actually do that. It's a very rare thing, but it's something that only great theater can do, and that production of Angels did it.
And I'm a little older than Isaac, and so I first came to the play as a college student, not by seeing it, but by reading it. You know, I was a drama major in college at the University of North Carolina. I grew up in Wisconsin, so I was not part of any, you know, I did not have access necessarily to the New York theater scene. I was not a kid who got to go to Broadway and see shows. And so my encounters with works of art like this often were because my fellow students were reading them. My professors were telling me that I should check them out. And so Angels came to me through it being published in American Theater Magazine, which is the way a lot of people, you know, theater lovers out in the hinterlands like me, got to first experience this play. And so to me, reading it, it was both galvanizing and it seemed impossible in a way. It seemed impossible that this thing I read on a page could actually be put on a stage, an impossibility that I think for many people involved in making Angels seemed quite literal for many years. It seemed like this impossible task that they could never truly succeed at. And then when I finally did get the chance to see it, you know, the summer after my sophomore year in college in New York, you know, on a kind of pilgrimage, my first trip to New York by myself where I got to see theater, it had a similarly sort of mind-blowing experience for me, even though the play did not take me by surprise exactly. The fact that they had succeeded, a thing that I doubted, even though I knew how many Tonys it had won, I knew it had won the Pulitzer Prize, I knew all that stuff, to actually still have it, to be in the same room with it, surrounded by an audience, still had that effect on me.
It's obviously a passion project for you both. And incredibly done. The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. Isaac Butler, Dan Coyce, thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That book, yours for a $120 contribution to KLW when you call 800-525-9917. Or if perhaps you'd like to see Angels in America, well, for a $500 contribution, we'll get you tickets to the full production of Angels in America at Berkeley Rep and throw in the book. 800-525-9917. We've got to go right now to my earlier recorded conversation with actors Stephen Spinella and Randy Harrison. Spinella, Randy Harrison, welcome to Open Air.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having us.
I want to start with you, Stephen. I'm so looking forward to what you do with Roy Cohn in part two, Perestroika. I had just finished rereading the script last night. There's some yummy scenes indeed. Such a repulsive character. Tell me what it was like, first of all, moving from Tony Award-winning playing a Walter Pryor some 25 years ago or so to playing Roy Cohn. Such polar opposites. Whose idea was it for you to take this up in the first place?
I don't know. I think I've heard a couple of different stories. Sometimes Tony Kushner says that it was his idea, and then sometimes Tony Taccone says it was his idea. I don't really care. It wasn't my idea. I don't know. It's Pryor and Roy are the two characters who die of AIDS or who have AIDS. Roy dies and Pryor doesn't. Pryor, you know, I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, did you have any
25 years ago?
Did you have any hesitation, or was it kind of an instant embrace?
Yeah, I didn't want to do it. I didn't think that I was really right for it. I don't. You know, I don't. The dialect was an issue, and the particular emotional range that he manifests in the play is not my métier, and I had like some problems with it, and I was obligated to another production, and I kept saying no, and then I got out of the other production, and I ended up doing it. So,
You've given Roy Cohn a couple of great physical tics, a little bit of a restless leg, I've noticed, and just something you're doing with your hand. Is that just something you brought to the character intrinsically, or did maybe Tony Taccone suggest it, or Where did you pick up those?
I don't know what you're talking about. Great. I'm glad
it works.
I'm glad you found that. The first scene, I realized that the very first scene in Millennium, he's very physically active, and it was important for me that that he be this incredibly vital, vibrant, alive, you know, guy in the first scene, because it's a straight decline to his death in the second play. And I was thinking about it the other day, he loses in every single scene. He loses in every single scene. And it's weird to play a character who loses as much as he does, except at the end of the play when he takes God as a client. Anyway, you'll see that. We restored a scene that has been cut since 1993.
We're going to talk about that shortly, about some of the revisions that are going on, but I wanted to get Randy involved in this conversation as well. Do you think, say, another few years down the road that you'd want to follow Stephen's lead and take on the role of Roy Cohn? Stephen is nodding for Randy. Yes.
I have no idea. I mean, much like Stephen, I would think I'd be wrong for it, but I don't know what I will be in 25 years, so we'll have to see that.
Well, other than Stephen's Tony Award-winning portrayal of Pryor Walter, where did you look for character development or inspiration, other than the amazing raw material that you have in Tony Kushner's script?
I mean, the script is obviously the first place. I did a lot of research. I mean, I grew up in the late 80s. I came out in the early 90s. So sort of many of the AIDS stories and the AIDS narrative was very familiar to me. So I went back and sort of watched all that stuff. But I found that when I started, when I reached out to the dramaturg a few weeks, maybe a month before rehearsal started, what I was most interested in was sort of the life of gay men in New York City before the epidemic hit. I'm not sure why, but I just felt like I needed to access who Pryor was then. So that there's so much life, and you know, even now more and more of gay history is emerging because, you know, I certainly wasn't taught it as a teenager, but as far as there's so much life and so many characters who were alive and thriving in New York in that time period, and I, you know, read old magazine articles, YouTube videos, I mean, anything I could find that documented that period and the gay men that were living in the city then, and just that kind of life energy.
Well, speaking of your age, at 40, you're almost a generation removed from what guys like Stephen were going through with his peers. Is there or was there more of a blasé attitude about HIV among your peers, both personally and professionally, when you were growing up?
I think I'm just old enough to have missed the blasé attitude. Like, I very much became sexually active in a time where it was all about, like, condom use and AIDS, like, AIDS education and safe sex practices. And AIDS was still very much, if it was stopping to be a death sentence, it was enough of, like, the education was very much a part. So I just am old enough to have never been blasé about, like, sexual health. And it certainly shaped the manner in which my sexuality evolved, because that was what being gay was to me at that time.
A very different time for you, Stephen. This work serves as such a testament to the very scary time when so much was unknown about this new disease, AIDS, now a treatable condition, not necessarily a death sentence. You lived through the heart of the epidemic. Now, how did it affect you on a personal level? You were a very early active member of ACT UP. It's loaded, I know.
Yeah, well, I don't know what part of that question to answer. You know, we were terrified. We were all terrified. This is for public radio. I don't know how to talk about this stuff. I mean, you know, oral sex was, you know, so unfun with condoms. And then, you know, new
still is.
and new information started to come out that maybe it's not, you can't get it that way. And, but who do you believe? And then when we were in ACT UP, it was like, the big thing that everybody kept saying was they just don't have the basic science on this. They just really don't know exactly how the immune system works. This is as much a learning curve for them as it is for anyone. I mean, they don't understand how this all works,
and the lack of a sense of urgency on their part too.
I don't know that I can completely agree with that. I mean, I think that there were certainly people in the government, horrible people in the government. I remember Ronald Reagan was set to give a speech on wherein he was going to say that saliva is not an avenue of transmission of HIV. And it was approved by the CDC. All of the doctors at the CDC agreed with this. It had gone through all kinds of levels of approval for him to say that to the American public. A man who barely mentioned AIDS was finally going to do the right thing. And the person who told him not to do that was the chief counsel for the president, a man named John Roberts, who is now the chief justice of the United States Supreme Court. He excised that from Ronald Reagan's speech so that, and actually changed the language, making it appear that it was uncertain as to whether saliva could transmit HIV. So there were a lot of very, very pernicious actors in the United States government, and not just in the government, but, you know, I mean, the religious right was, you know, an apostasy against God in their behavior to gay people around this crisis. And it was, you know, I mean, that is all true. What isn't there were many, many very good actors who really, really worked very hard, who were not a part of the gay community, who worked very hard to try to get this disease under control. And yeah, I mean, when you the documentary with Peter Staley and you know, what was that called? That doctor?
How to Survive a Plague.
How to Survive a Plague, yes. I mean, that articulates the feeling at that time, and a little bit later, actually, than I was in ACT UP. I was in ACT UP in 87, 88, and it was really later that they got into much more of going and actually trying to develop drugs and working with pharmaceutical companies, trying to develop drugs and getting the FDA to not necessitate double-blind studies and all of this. I mean, it was an incredibly complicated, desperate, terrifying time. And you know, there were some incredibly bad actors who are still alive today and are still bad actors. And but there were a lot of people who really tried to do the right thing.
Getting back to the work that Tony whittled down, so to speak, reading in The World Only Spins Forward about all of the very last-minute changes that happened in the script, even up to opening night, not to mention the massive paring down of the telephone book-like original drafts that gushed forth from Tony Kushner, what was the state of a final script when you came into the picture? Was there?
When I came in?
When you came in, when as this is being developed, did you even have a final script, or was it constantly being revised?
Well, I mean, he wrote the part for me, so I was in it from the very beginning. I was there when it was an idea. You work with Tony Kushner, and you're working with a person who is constantly thinking and rethinking and rethinking and rethinking. And, you know, he comes out with something that's quite remarkable on the first take. Look, I just did a play with him in 2010 at 2009 in Minnesota, where on the first day of a rehearsal, there were no pages. There were no pages. On the second day of rehearsal, there were 7 pages. On the third day of rehearsal, there were 23 pages. And that is how we progressed. And it's just like he wrote the play. The actors were in the room waiting for something to do, and he wrote the play as it came out of it. He's notoriously behind schedule, famously behind schedule. And this wasn't any different. I mean, he Millennium was pretty much written and set by the summer of 90. I want to say the summer of 90. We did a production of it in Los Angeles at the Taper 2. If I remember this right, and of Millennium. And Millennium was already pretty much done. And he was putting feelers into Perestroika. One of the scenes that took place in Millennium is now in Perestroika. And, you know, so that play has been set for a very long time. It was Perestroika that has always been the more difficult reach for him. And when he finished Perestroika, we were doing it at the Eureka. We had a 6.5-hour rehearsal day per our equity contract. The play was longer than could be read in one rehearsal day per our equity contract.
Well, I understand
that. And that was just Perestroika.
Wow.
Just Perestroika.
I understand at one point, I don't know if it was for the part one or part two, you actually had to become a spokesperson for the cast and saying, look, we need to at least get a run through before the public is allowed to see this.
Oh, I don't know. That sounds like something any number of people would have said.
And have you seen some of these earlier drafts? I understand that even Isaac Butler and Dan Coys, who know the work so well, say they haven't even heard some of the dialogue that I guess Tony, one of the two Tonys, either Tacconi or Kushner, has reincorporated into this Berkeley Rep version. So I guess that means that, at least for Perestroika, it's still a living work that doesn't have a definitive version yet.
Well, I would say they're both a living work. We restored a scene that had been cut in 93. They didn't. We did it in L.A. And then when we got to Broadway, we changed directors, and it just didn't fit. As Tony kept saying, the play didn't seem to want the scene, and they couldn't really find the right place for it. And I was talking to Randy very early on in the rehearsal process about how much I wanted to restore that scene, mm-hmm. just because I wanted us to do it and nobody else.
It fits.
And it fits.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it in there. Mm. And it's a fun, nasty little scene with Roy Cohn. And
maybe it'll come out at some point. Now, in a big way, I think Randy has it a bit easier in this production, as basically not having to have gone through the wrestling, the broken friendships, the deaths, the contract negotiations that brought this work to life. So you just basically have to learn your lines, I think.
That's all I had to do. That's the only thing I did do.
Looking to your elder statesman for inspiration.
I mean, I do think that, you know, this play, I had a different kind of historical baggage with this play because it came out when I was 16, and I was joking about how, like, acting class from like 1994 to like 2000, like till now, it's just like I've seen every acting student's like in acting class, every, you know, this, all these scenes are iconic to me. So to like try to shed all this baggage of my personal history of watching the show many times and seeing other people explore the show and be like, it's this scene, it's the scene when Pryor does this, and I'm like, no, it's just a play, I'm just start from scratch. I've had to sort of shed a different kind of baggage.
And it has to be emotionally and physically exhausting to go through this for the duration of the run that we're doing here at Berkeley Rep.
It is.
Steven's mouth is dropping, to say it lightly, I guess.
You know, the hard thing is the thing that you do as a stage actor is you find, you learn where you need to put your energy. As you perform the play, the first performances is your energy is just pouring out of you everywhere. And then slowly you begin to understand, oh, no, I can conserve here, I can conserve here, I can conserve here, and this is where I really need to pour it out. Learning that for this play has been, for this, you know, the two plays together, in part because there is so much material, but also because the play demands a kind of size in it's just life. You just have to live big in this play. Small, subtle, you know, nuanced stuff. You've got to do all of that, but you've got to still live big. And I mean, it's not like a lot of plays. You have to constantly pour it out there. And only now am I starting to learn, oh, okay, this is, I can kind of conserve here and I can kind of conserve here, because I've got, this is really where I need to pour it on. And it's, you know, when we were doing this, I don't know if this is in the book, but when we were doing this on Broadway, Danny Zellman, who was my cover, said to me one time, he said, you know, we were all sitting in the audience watching you guys do this, and when I went on, my experience of sitting in the audience and watching you do this is you're just talking to each other. And suddenly I went on, and suddenly everybody started screaming at me. He said the experience of it on stage with the other actor, just coming into it completely raw without having like developed into it, is that everybody is yelling at everybody. And that is the experience that I have here, is we have to be completely full voice. The theater is, you know, it's 600-700 seats. We have to be completely full voice for 7 hours in emotionally intense material. And it's sentences that have to be phrased so that the meaning is clear, and it's a workout. Yeah. Every show is a workout.
Given recent events from before the election to these surreal couple of years we've been living through, it's almost like the very fabric of society is unraveling again. So I think it's a very timely anniversary to bring Angels back to the stage to make people think about what's going on.
This period of history feels more dangerous than any period of history I have ever lived through. I think we are in greater in the 80s, there was a dismantling of the health of people's bodies. Right now, I feel like what is happening is they are dismantling fundamental notions of how we live together. Ideas like the rule of law have become up for grabs.